The book is a substantial tome, a thesis with the sober title, Religious Rhetoric in U.S. Right-Wing Politics, Donald Trump, Intergroup Threat, and Nationalism. With all the analyses of our recent era from U.S. political journalists and partisan analysts, it's good to get the observations and insights of a scholar who may be both more dispassionate and comprehensive. And so I am happy to welcome author Chiara Migliori. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What got you interested in focusing on this troubling moment in American history and the collision of religion and politics?
Well, I can answer with a two-part answer, actually. One goes back to my first year of university here in Italy, where I attended my first class in Anglo-American literature. But instead of studying literature, the professor took us through the journey that brought Christianity, religion, and specifically Christianity to the United States. And there I discovered something I had never realized, which is the importance and the huge role of religion in the country. And from then on, I just devoted my studies to finding out more about it. I also wrote my master's thesis on Christian fundamentalism in the history of the United States. And I've always been fascinated by this topic, by the just how vital religion is in the United States. And I think the second thing that led me to study this specific moment in time, so Donald Trump, the religious right, and Christian voters of Donald Trump, is the fact that I really want to try to understand people who think differently than me. I do not belong to the ideological currents of the people who supported Donald Trump. Like, my political beliefs are somehow much different from theirs. But I've always been really interested in trying to understand what brings people to support figures such as Donald Trump, and specifically to try to understand how is it possible that people at some point or in the course of their life begin to feel threatened by diversification, by religious, ethnic, and cultural minorities, by the LGBTQI+. And how come that people feel so threatened that then they are appealed by figures such as Donald Trump, who promises them that to return to this mythical past where their identity, their culture, and their religion was cherished and was valued? So that's my main aim, try to understand where people come from, ideologically and politically speaking.
Mm. The astounding damage of Trumpism and the collusion of the political religious right is something most Americans might acknowledge, but a scholarly look seems impossible when there's nonstop noise on social media and political broadcasts. So we look overseas for a more sober and dispassionate analysis. Do you think Europeans are deeper thinkers, or it's just that history goes back a lot further in Europe, while Americans still think of everything as being novel and original?
I do not think we are deeper thinkers. But I think the reason is precisely what you just said, is because here on the other side of the pond, we can have a much more detached look on what's going on in the United States. This, on the other hand, also means, of course, that we lack the cultural identity, historical traits, and capacity to really deeply understand the North American culture and how politics in the United States works. And it is true that we have a longer history, of course, but what is also undeniable is that we are imbued with Western and specifically US culture. And we actually often look with we look at the US with some sort of anticipation of things that might arrive here as well. Sometimes these things are positive, sometimes they aren't. For example, Steve Bannon and his attempts at establishing a religious political organization here in Italy is an example of an undesired US product. But it's definitely true that we can we can look at the United States history, but in particular current political situation with a more detached look. That's why probably we can allow ourselves to exit all this noise bubble, which is very strong here as well, but all this noise noise from political commentators, etc. And we can allow ourselves to exit this bubble and just look at the United States with a more sober look.
Kira, would you give us some examples of the religious rhetoric that you focus on in this book?
Yes, I focused on these three actors: Donald Trump, religious rights, prominent organizations, by which I mean pro-family, pro-life organizations such as the Family Research Council, Heritage Foundation, Alliance Defending Freedom, and others. And the third actor are these ordinary voters, so people who are not involved in the political or lobbying activity of the religious right. And I focused, with regard to Donald Trump, I focused very much on his slogans, because what I realized was that he wasn't really using religious talk to depict, to portray himself as a deeply religious or spiritual person. He was using religious Christian symbols as to craft these very powerful slogans that he would then shout during his rallies, such as "Nothing beats the Bible" or "The promise, we're going to say Merry Christmas again." And then with regard to the religious right, I focused, well, I did some interviews with some members of this this coalition, we can call it, but I focused in particular on the Washington updates, which are these very short articles published by the Family Research Councils, which read major events of the past week or the past days from a religious conservative perspective. And I tried to find some similarities, some points in common between the discourse of the religious right and of Donald Trump's Christian voters. And what came up is that they both use very much this rights talk. Of course, I'm not the one who coined this expression, but they make great use of this rights talk. So they frame their battles, their claims, in as a fight between their a fight for the protection of their rights to religious freedom and freedom of speech against the claims of what they consider undeserving individuals in the United States. So religion itself is not really a huge part of this discourse.
So is that what you saw as different from earlier election cycles, or if say what you did see as most different?
I would say that, well, first of all, of course, Donald Trump is a novelty, but he is a novel phenomenon steeped in a Western U.S. tradition. Mm-hmm. He ran for the Republican Party, and so he knew he had to appeal to conservative Christian voters or self-identified evangelicals, self-identified Christians. And he also knew he had to do some gestures of differentiation towards religious organizations and towards his Christian electorate. And so that's what concerns the traditional path that he followed. He adopted the same slogan as Ronald Reagan. He nominated pro-life and conservative justices. He created this evangelical advisory board. But of course, there are some novel elements in Donald Trump's figure. One of these elements, it's the fact that he never really tried to come across as a deeply spiritual person, a deeply religious person. Besides, when he was, for example, in the same room with evangelical pastors, religious leaders who would lay hands on him, those were the only occasions where we could see really Donald Trump in a religious environment. But as I said, one of the main differences between him and previous Republican candidates was that he would only use religious talk and religious symbols as part of his rants, his slogans. And then another difference was, of course, his massive use of social media and Twitter in particular, which was the thing that made him, which made his supporters feel him so close to them and so similar to them. That's what I would say are the main differences with regard to Donald Trump and religion, and between Donald Trump and his Republican predecessors.
So would you say that Trump was unique or part of a global populism mixed with nationalism that seems to just keep growing?
Unfortunately, I'm afraid Donald Trump is a perfect product of this right-wing populist, nationalist, authoritarian trend that is sweeping through most Western democracies. And we have also here in Italy many figures who think he constitutes a very good example for their political behavior. And they are also they're also starting to use religion and religious talk the same way he used it. I think Donald Trump, no, I don't think he is unique. Maybe he was the loudest so far and the most out there and evident. And, of course, he has been the president of the United States, and we are used, especially here in the Western Hemisphere, we are used to consider the President of the United States as one of the most important and powerful figures in the world. So, of course, he has much more resonance, and he occupies the news much more than than our own Matteo Salvini or Giorgia Meloni.
Yeah, religion has a uniquely powerful political role in Italy. How does familiarity with that inform your writing? Are there warnings that you think Americans should have in mind?
I think the role and the history of Catholicism here in Italy definitely informed my way of thinking. I have never really been a churchgoer, but of course, growing up in Italy, most of us are kind of used to seeing religious symbols and churches and Catholic culture almost everywhere. I think religion and religion's role in Italy influenced my way of thinking about this topic, religion and politics in the US, meaning that I constantly think about the difference between here and the United States. Here in Italy, surely because of our longer history, religion is much more an institution. It's incorporated. It's almost systemic. And it's such a deeply rooted element of our history that probably that's why it lacks the vitality and the appeal that it instead has in the United States. And I don't think Americans should look at our situation to draw some teachings, whereas I think the opposite is true. Because as I said, prominent right-wing figures here in Italy are taking the U.S. and Trump, as and the religious right as an example, and are increasingly making use of this of religious symbols and to garner much more consensus. So I think we should be worried that.
Is there a core thesis that you present in this book, and is it more focused on recent history or a process that is still evolving?
Well, in my book, I want to make two things clear. One is that, as I said earlier, Donald Trump is not a total novelty, and we have to look at the recent past if 4 or 5 decades can still be considered recent past to understand where he came from, why he used religious talk the way he used it, and why he had such an impressive success. That's why I also focus on the history of the religious right and on what brought these white conservative Christian voters to develop these feelings of resentment, displacement, and anger that then fuel their white identity politics. And the second thing I try to convey is that it's crucial that we listen to the words of those who supported him. Now, of course, I stand on the shoulders of giants in this field, both as far as history is concerned and with regard to quantitative analysis, the data, the numbers, and all the very detailed pictures that many scholars provide us of the American electorate. But what I really wanted to convey was the importance of letting these people talk about themselves, about their history, their beliefs, both religious and political. And these talks revealed the pervasiveness of this idea of being attacked as Christians, of being labeled as bigots, racists, haters, feeling out of place within a country and a culture and a society that changed so much. And they are feeling silenced and disrespected. And of course, I'm not condoning these feelings, and I don't think they are justifiable, but they are there and they are valid for the people who have them. And we have to listen to the words, to their words, to really understand why Trump's figure and his discourse resonated so strongly with these people.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you know, many Americans truly believe the Trump era is over, and they talk about normalcy has returned. A visit to countless political, social, and religious gathering places would quickly prove them wrong. So what will it take for them to wake up, and what should they have learned from these events? What should the world have learned?
Well, what will it take for them to wake up? I would think that January 6th was a pretty strong wake-up call, seeing those horrifying images and all that violence, but maybe it wasn't enough. I think what we all can learn from this, from the past 6-7 years, is to be more active, socially and politically speaking. I think we have to participate even by simply voting, and we cannot discard the dangerousness of certain political actors. Of course, I'm talking about our countries, the countries where we are lucky enough to be able to still go to the polls. We have to learn to talk to people, even to those whose idea we might find unbearable or we might despise, especially to these people we have to learn to talk to. And what as I said, what I'm observing here in Italy, apart from the success of these right-wing populist authoritarian figures, is the growth of these so-called political influencers, quote unquote, who are people who didn't have anything to do with politics until a few years ago. And then they decided that they weren't liking anymore what the government was doing, especially during the pandemic. And so they took to Facebook and started lamenting and began gaining impressive amounts of followers. And the problem with these people, who quite often actually look at figures like Trump as examples of what they would like to do, what they would like to be in their political behavior, the problem with these people is that they more often than not convey some pretty awful, reactionary, authoritative, and racist messages. And so I wouldn't want to end this conversation with a pessimistic note, but I really do not think that Trump will be the last such figure that we will witness, neither in the US nor here in Europe. And the pandemic destroyed our certainties, and thousands of people are fleeing their countries, and there is a lot of fear, wanting of protectionism, wanting to reaffirm one's own culture, identity, national boundaries. And so, yeah, we have to remain vigilant and engage.
Chiara Migliori earned her PhD in 2020 from the Graduate School of North American Studies at the John F. Kennedy Institute of the Free University in Berlin, Germany. Her book is titled Religious Rhetoric in U.S. Right-Wing Politics, Donald Trump, Intergroup Threat and Nationalism. Chiara, thank you so much for being with us from Italy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It was great talking to you. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. Your donations help keep us on the air. Information on how to donate is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be part of the conversation. Social media helps connect like-minded people in conversation and company. I'd ask you to share State of Belief with just one person this week for whom you think this might be helpful. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. Yes, he was. He was. Mm-hmm.